Well, this morning the challenge is, I was talking to Harold about this morning, and I said, the challenge is we can't cover all of Stephen's apologetic. Where do you cut it off at? That is the real challenge. And some of you may think, oh, you should have cut it off sooner, or others, like, you could have taken more. So I'll let you wrestle with that. But actually, what I'd like you to wrestle with this morning is a response. But before I send out the response and how we're going to look at this, if you are able to stand, muster up those calories from the donut to stand. I would actually like to read kind of where this left off before Stephen actually talks. And so I want to read just verses 8 through 15 to kind of set the stage for where we're going. So in Acts chapter 6, starting in verse 8, it says, "And Stephen, full of grace and power, was performing great wonders and signs among the people. But some men from what was called the synagogue of the freedmen, including both Cyrenians and Alexandrians, some from Cilicia and Asia, rose up and argued with Stephen, but they were unable to cope with the wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking. They then secretly induced men to say, 'We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God.' And they stirred up the people, the elders and the scribes, and they came up to him and drug him away and brought him before the council. They put forward false witnesses who said, 'This man incessantly speaks against this holy place and the law. For we have heard him say that this Nazarene, Jesus, will destroy this place and alter the customs which Moses handed down to us.' And fixing their gaze on him, all who were sitting in the council saw his face like the face of an angel." So we're going to tackle this by the way it starts. I don't know if we got a problem again. Maybe we do. Let's see. Yeah, it's dead. Let me see if I got other batteries. Otherwise, we may be in trouble with these. We are going to look at verses 1 through 8. So go ahead and chapter 7. That's where we're starting first. And we're really going to talk about, let's see if this does anything. Nope, batteries are dead. So go ahead and turn the slide if you guys don't mind doing that at first. And then maybe Zach can run some batteries down to me. It's not showing up. Let me see here. Well, let's see. Okay, it works. All right, let's read verses 1 through 8 together. It says, "The high priest said, 'Are these things so?'" This is the response to all this. "And he said," Stephen is speaking, "he said, 'Hear me, brethren and fathers, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran. And he said to him, Leave your country and your relatives and come into the land which I will show you. Then he left the land of the Chaldeans and settled into Haran. And from there, after his father died, God had him move to this country in which you are now living. But he gave him no inheritance in it, not even a foot of ground. And yet, even when he had no child, he promised that he would give it to him as a possession and to his descendants after him." So actually, we're going to stop at verse 5. So he begins this defense. So it starts, obviously, with the high priest asking for a defense. The thing we have to understand is the charges, in essence, are about speaking against God, more specifically about speaking against God, against Moses. The two things that are mentioned at the end of chapter 6 is the law and the temple. And so the idea is, are these charges true? Is that what you're doing, Stephen? And so you have to defend yourself, Stephen. So what this does is it affords an opportunity, not just really for Stephen to defend himself, but to lay things out. So this is an opportunity. If you want to look at the book of Acts, this is probably one of the greater apologetics, looking from the beginning of the Old Testament with Abraham on, and really showing where the Jews at that time who did not come to faith in Jesus had missed the whole point of where everything was pointing. But it's funny because when you think about defending himself, Stephen is going to teach what is true, but he's going to do it in such a way to instruct. He's not just going to defend himself. So instead of saying, no, I didn't say this, what he's going to do is point out what the truth is. And which in a way is a defense, but it's a different defense than you would expect. You would not expect to go to court and defend yourself in this manner. So what he does, though, is he starts out, and I think this is important, and you might say, well, we can just pass through verse 2, right? But ask yourself, how was he approaching these men that are sitting there judging these accusations about speaking against the law, against Moses, against the temple? Well, he starts out by identifying with them as brothers and fathers. Why? Because they have commonality, a Jewish commonality. But having a Jewish commonality, we can go all the way back to, which is what he'll do, the book of Genesis. Oh, back to a promise, which we'll get in this minute. And so we've got the same foundation as the idea. So he's referring to them, first of all. And you might say, oh, well, this is how you would always do it. Well, no, it's not just how you'd always do it, because we can start with the commonality that we're here in Jerusalem for a reason. And that reason stems all the way back to the book of Genesis with Abraham. And so if you'll notice the way it kind of unfolds, he says, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham. Now, I think it's important. It's not going to spend a lot of time on it, but it starts out with God doing this, the God of glory, and how God is the one to appear to Abraham. Of course, he was Abram at the time, right? And gave him direction in relationship to what? The covenant. Verse 3 is about this covenant that he is making with him. And so it is to what? To leave your country, your relatives. Go to another land. And you know, if you have to boil down, one thing seminary did was I got to boil down three things very good. Is the covenants, but also within the covenants. Abrahamic covenant can boil down to it's a land, seed, blessing. And to be in the land, it's not where he's at. He has to go to it. And oh, by the way, seed means that there's a problem. Abraham has no offspring. How's that going to work? Well, obviously, Stephen's not going to preach the whole thing, but this is implied, right? And so it describes, what's unique though in verse 4 is you would think he doesn't get right to the promise out. He stops. And he talked about he left for the land of Chaldeans, settled in Haran. Why is that mentioned? Well, because he did settle in Haran. But it's talking about really there was this journey and they settled temporarily in Haran before leaving for the land of Palestine. And what Stephen is doing is, so he is contrasting. Abraham does not have inheritance in the land yet, but yet there is that promise again in verse 5. He gave him no inheritance in it and not even a foot of ground. And yet, even when he had no child, he promised that he would give it to him as a possession. So there is this promise, even though he is childless. And I was thinking about this, and sometimes it's, I always say this, this is probably true for a lot of you, if you kind of read and study a passage and spend time thinking about it, I think sometimes God will bring up a situation that you're in, and you can turn around and say, you know what, I just learned, it seems like it might fit your situation. I was encouraging my daughter with this. You know, think about Abraham and the fact that when he left to go there, he had no child. And, you know, it's kind of part of that promise is you're not just going to a land. You've got to have a child because you've got to have descendants. So that means you've got to trust God. There is faith in God to be able to move and act upon this promise that he is giving you that's not there yet. And I would stop here and say, so if again, this is the defense, right? What is Stephen trying to do that really points out where these guys are at compared to where Abraham was? Well, there's a big contrast. So the father of Judaism, that's what we would think of as Abraham, is willing to depart from where he was in order to follow God into an unknown territory, by the way, without a child yet. And the reason he does it is on the word of God alone, literally the word from God, literally spoken directly to him. Here we have the Sanhedrin, and since that time of Abraham, think of all the promises that direct towards a Messiah coming. This is the Messiah that they actually put to death. But you know what they're upset about? The law or the traditions, the customs. They would much rather have the comfortability of tradition over what the Word of God promises. And I would also say sometimes there's a lot of people who would much rather have comfortability of traditions, and we're just going to keep those rather than relying on God's promises. But again, he's drawing a point. Now, he hasn't said it yet, but a lot of this is implied until, and we're not going there today, but until he connects the dots at the end, and then he gets himself killed. But that was God's design, right? So then we look at 6 through 8. And it says, but God spoke to this effect, that his descendants would be aliens in a foreign land, that they would be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years in whatever nation to which they will be in bondage. I myself will judge, said God. And after that, they will come out and serve me in this place. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs. So, Stephen mentions, he's jumping ahead, right? There's going to be a period of time you're going to have descendants and they're going to be enslaved for 400 years. And you might say, well, wow, that's really, Stephen's explaining this and he's putting the cart way ahead of the horse, right? You don't have, as he's walking through, he hasn't gotten to the fact that he said Isaac, but that's assumed and he'll get back to it. But did you know he already said that? I mean, this is just a reminder. This is he's reviewing things that are in Scripture. So before he even had a son, though, that was promised, because we see that in Genesis 15. It says, now, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. He was Abram at that time, not Abraham. And behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, for they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. So again, these are all these things that are happening before he has a child. And then what is also brought up is circumcision by Stephen, that it did happen, and then he did have a son. And oh, by the way, this was the covenant had this sign, and it was called circumcision. And the sign is a reminder that God delivered what he had promised. And it was the seal of the Abrahamic covenant. It was not the covenant. But it's the emphasis again on what it means. There, obviously, if we were to preach that section, we would spend a lot more time talking about in depth about it. But again, we're looking at what is he doing by explaining this. In one sense, he's talking about following through on these promises. And then when he does fulfill that promise, there's a sign, and it's the sign of circumcision. And so he mentions the sign of circumcision because because he recognizes its purpose, but it's not what held the covenant together. That's what God is. And this is why it ends up, you will see the topic of circumcision discussed quite a bit in the book of Acts, which we haven't. As you see where we're at, we're in what, chapter 7? But it becomes a hot-button topic. Why? Because it's almost as if circumcision is like its own covenant, like this conditional thing. No, it was always a sign of the Abrahamic covenant. But now we're looking at who is Stephen addressing, and they love the customs and the traditions. And it becomes more important than the covenant itself. See, God, if you want to consider this, God in his covenants, if we want to put the major ones, the Abrahamic covenant, Davidic covenant, the new covenant, those things have been the foundations of how he's building and reconciling man. And Jesus finds his lineage all the way through. And sometimes we can focus on the other things out that are related with the covenant, but they're not the covenant themselves. And this is a problem. Again, he's dealing with traditions, but it's all implied at this point in time because he hasn't really started to connect things when he will. So that was Abraham. And then he moves on to Joseph. So look at verses 9 and 10 as we talk about Joseph. It says, the patriarchs became jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt. Yet God was with him and rescued him from all his afflictions and granted him favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he made him governor over Egypt and all his household. Now what's interesting is we skipped a lot there, right? Story of Joseph is a fascinating story. It's where we think of the scripture, what? When Joseph is talking to his brothers, he tells them what? You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. But he summarized everything in here, right? But it is it's funny because I've seen churches that I don't think they really preach the gospel, but they'll have Joseph musicals in their church. Joseph in the Technicolor Coat of Dreams. Although they missed the whole emphasis of what happened with Joseph, but that's getting off track. But what is it about Joseph? Well, Joseph is in that line of the descendants. But how did he get brought up? How's he come here? Well, if you remember, verse 8 said Jacob was the father of the 12 patriarchs, 12 brothers. And you know, so this is circling back before the time before they go into enslavement. And, you know, we know about Joseph. But it's a recap, really small recap, short, succinct summary from his betrayal to exaltation. But it really started with what? It started with jealousy. And that's what verse 9 talks about. Became jealous of Joseph. Now, how did they become jealous of Joseph? Because he told them about his prophetic dreams. And if we're honest about it, I don't know, the word tact might be a word that would be used on how you present it. Was he, and it was absolutely true. Those dreams got fulfilled. But they became jealous. And you know, this is not in my notes, but I just thought, you know, there's another line of thread here when I think about the Sanhedrin. What is going on that's driven them to this hatred over these apostles and now Stephen? Do you think jealousy has something to do with it? Because why? We were perfectly in line for keeping our religion and our covenants the way we see fit with God. And now you've come in and upset the apple cart. And you're talking about this Messiah has come. And this is not the way we've got it pictured. But here's Joseph. And yet in the midst of these afflictions, we know that God rescued Joseph, but it's funny because how he rescues him from the afflictions is to take him through the afflictions, right? And it ends up, he becomes what? Governor over Egypt, so in this higher ranking position. But to get there, it was filled with all kinds of afflictions. We don't need to go through them, but you know, it's like it's getting bad. Well, we're not going to kill him, throw him in the pit, sell him into slavery. And then he's in slavery. It looks like things are getting better. They get bad. You know, because there's this wife of Potiphar that she had an eye out for Joseph. And then that gets bad. So then he's in Egypt. He's in jail. And then he hears dreams. He interprets the dreams that through God's power. And ironically, too, how does he get to that point? Well, I don't want to jump ahead. That's my notes here. But Joseph, his all of a sudden ends up in this exalted position, which is perfect for what God has planned. Dr. Constable, I'm quoting him directly, so I'm going to give him credit. He said, like Joseph, Jesus' brethren rejected and literally sold him for the price of a slave. That was a betrayal. Nevertheless, God was with Joseph and Jesus. God exalted Joseph under Pharaoh and placed him authority over his domain. God has done the same with Jesus. So again, there's some implied connections of what's going on right now, but it's not overt. But he continues with discussing about Joseph and using him for his purposes as we look at why did he go through this? Why did he need to be in Egypt ultimately? There were bigger events happening than just peace was made in the family, right? So starting in verse 11, we read, "Now a famine came over all Egypt and Canaan, and a great affliction with it, and her fathers could find no food. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent our fathers there the first time." Notice, by the way, I just got to point that out, our fathers. So again, he's making the connection how we're all related, Stephen is. But in verse 12, it says, "But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent our fathers there the first time. On the second visit, Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and Joseph's family was disclosed to Pharaoh. Then Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come to him, 75 persons in all. And Jacob went down to Egypt, and there he and our fathers died. From there, they were removed to Shechem and laid in the tomb which Abraham had purchased for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor in Shechem." So there is an Egyptian purpose for all of this, for Joseph to be where he's at. And so it starts with the famine. Because here's the thing, we ended with the patriarchs in the line of these descendants. These patriarchs would become the 12. Starts with the letter T. 12 tribes, right? But there's a problem because there's a famine and that'll wipe people out. So what do you do? Well, you just got to survive. And by the way, it's not just for you. It's your livestock to take care of yourself. What do you do? Well, they're going to find out about Egypt, right? But what is not mentioned in here, but it's there, obviously, is that how did this all come about? Circle back to the dreams. How did he get to the place of not just... Because God could have used any different way to get Joseph exalted. I truly believe that. God honestly can do a number of different things if he chooses to. But there's a point and a purpose to it. Because one of those dreams was what? How about storing food? Because a famine was coming, and so that's exactly what Egypt did. So Egypt was prepared as opposed to everyone else in that region. And so then if people needed food, they were going to make out like bandits. It's kind of like the silliness of when everyone was hoarding toilet paper during the pandemic. And some people were selling it online. It wasn't, except this was done legally, all right, because God told them to store up the grain. But this is really what it is. That's how they make money, as well as their wealth and everything else. And of course, that led to Joseph being exalted, all these things, and more. But it put him in a position that was necessary, right? And so Jacob, the father of the 12, sent the rest of the brothers to Egypt because he hears about there's grain there. We got to survive. And this led to a second trip. Of course, what's not mentioned is, you know, keeping the one brother and just that whole, the way it played out. But when they returned, he revealed himself to them. But ultimately, this is the way God was able to work this reconciliation with these brothers. And the blessing really was what? That they could then come live in Egypt? Not getting grain. They're living there, so they've got access. Because Pharaoh hears this is his family. So this family gets to get taken care of. And evidently, they got taken care of very well. Because when we finish with that story, and we go into the Exodus, the book of Exodus, that is, there's a lot of descendants there. So they're not eating just peanut butter sandwiches. Their animals are getting taken care of. They're able to thrive. Because Egypt was thriving because of Joseph's position and what he had set up. There's something else I want to bring up. And some of the commentators like are questioning what's the point about Shechem, what's brought up about Shechem. And I'll make the point here in a minute. But the mention of Shechem is a reminder of Genesis 12, 6, and 7, where it says, Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants, I will give this land. So he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him at Shechem. Right? And then Joshua 24:32 states that Jacob bought this tomb there and purchased the land in which he built it. Abraham did not settle there, however, and the land apparently reverted back to the people of Hamor, but then Jacob then repurchased it from Shechem. Now, I got to ask you before, why mention this? That's like, we're not giving all the details. I mean, there's so much you could give about Joseph. We're not going to tell all that, but we're going to tell you about Shechem. Did he get distracted and say, oh, look, rabbit, squirrel, Shechem. Oh, it's over here. Why did he bring that up? Everyone kind of mentioned this. It's very fascinating if you understand what is the apologetic. The apologetic is, it's this place, it's this temple, it's our traditions, customs that you're speaking against. Because this is how you get right with God. This is how you're in God's covenant, right? And by the way, we talked about the law, we talked about the customs, the oral tradition that had just as much stature as the law itself. So what's important, I think, is mentioning the place of Shechem. It's something unique as it refers to burial, but if you think about in Stephen's day, what is Shechem? It is a Samaritan territory. You know, a good Jewish person has not taken their vacation there in the first century to Samaria. And Stephen really is reminding the Sanhedrin that their ancestral deliverer, Joseph, the one that is held in high esteem, was buried in the land that Orthodox Jews did not want to go into. Again, another instance of where, you know what? God is working in places, not just, quote, right in the promised land. And what did Jesus say? I mean, go back and think. It pops to my mind when he's talking to the woman at the well in Samaria. And there's this argument. Well, I worship here because this is the well that Jacob gave. But you go worship in the temple. So the Samaritan woman is kind of putting her nods, okay, geographical, this is what we're talking about. What did Jesus say? There's a time coming, you're no longer going to, it's not going to be about location. You're going to worship in spirit and truth. Because by the way, you are the temple because God dwells in you, the Holy Spirit dwells inside of you. Because you are saved in Christ Jesus. But again, to begin to understand that, it is going to attack this idea of this is where everything happens. Now, by the way, I'm not saying there's not prophetic events that involve the land of Israel and a temple and all that, but what I'm saying is that it took on a different stature. And so this is the first century. There is a temple there, and what Stephen is saying is you missed the point. You miss God for the whole other stuff. So then we go to Moses. Got to talk about Moses, right? We had Father Abraham, had many sons. I'm just going to make you sing the song in your head. Then we had Joseph. And now we have Moses. So Moses takes us up to where? To the book of Exodus. So in verses 17 through 22... we see God's sovereignty in dealing with a cruel dictator. So starting in verse 17, it says, but at this time of the promise was approaching, which God had assured to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt until there arose another king over Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph. It was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers. Again, notice our race, our fathers, so that they would expose their infants and they would not survive. And it was at this time that Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of God, and he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. And after he had been set outside, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. So it picks up with the increase, right? Which is a reminder, Genesis 12, 1 through 3 on display. When the promise was made to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you, make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. The one who curses you, I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. So again, this is just the reminder of God working through and fulfilling his promise. But we notice there's a difference. The protection of the patriarchs and their families that led to this vast increase in Egypt now leads to another problem, which was prophesied to Abraham, we mentioned before, that they would be enslaved. Because a newer pharaoh or king of Egypt didn't have a relationship, didn't know Joseph, and he's threatened by these aliens that are living there because they don't want to be overtaken. That's the way they view it. It's the enemy. In fact, what Stephen explains even is how wicked the Egyptians were at that time to these descendants so that the population would start dying off. Why would you mistreat the kid? You know, why would you just kill off the adults? The idea is we're gonna decrease the size of this nation first as their slaves. And so there were all wicked things to be done, and we'll talk about that in a second. But it's interesting because even in the midst of this, there's a theme like with Joseph, the treacherous dealing with those of Abraham's seed, and specifically when we come to Moses, it's how Moses got into that position. It never would have happened. Let that sink in. As crazy as that story is about Moses being an infant, being hidden, why? Because the fear was that the edict, which I didn't put down here for reading, but it was the edict was what? Throw him in the river. That comes, by the way, after the response of, well, kind of kill the child in childbirth. Well, that's what Exodus 1, that was the point. Exodus 1, 15 through 20, the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. One of them was named Shiphrah. Another was named Puah, and he said, When are you helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool? If it is a son, you shall put him to death. If it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So then that led to the next edict about then all male children, we're just going to go find them and throw them in the Nile. Kill them. So that leads to what? Moses, right? Because Moses' mother has a baby, is protecting it, puts it in a basket. It's got pitch all around it, right? Putting it somewhere safe. And who finds the basket with the baby? One of Pharaoh's daughters. Has pity, takes Moses to be in as her very own son. Now, Stephen doesn't tell all these details and more. Except what he's highlighting is that the fact that he gets taken in, and actually, you know, we also learn how Moses' own mother gets actually be the caregiver at the same time, while having the protection and then having the best. But this led for Moses to become not just in the right position, but he was well equipped, right? Now, I know sometimes people read Daniel. That's a problem with any narrative. Don't read the narrative and say, this is the edict for everyone. Like Daniel, it's like, well, we didn't eat the king's food and do all that. We're going to do something different. Well, that was unique for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But it's not, well, I'm sorry, for Daniel. But it's not the issue here. There's nothing wrong with what Moses got for his instruction. In fact, you could say in one sense it gave him not just only the clout, but probably gave him the ability to understand a bit about leadership. Now, God could have done that on his own. And we know, by the way, which is not told here, but we know, by the way, Moses kind of tried to balk at the idea of being a leader. In reality, God had him equipped. But here's what's unique. Think about this. The great deliverer within the monumental time of the Exodus, this great deliverer, he was born, preserved, protected, and educated in Egypt. Now think about who he's addressing. Because there's a sense everything happens here in Jerusalem. And so what is Stephen doing? He's pointing this out. And oh, by the way, Jesus was not born in Jerusalem. He was from Nazareth. Or do you have to say it like this? Nazareth. I don't know. And where's his ministry? Predominantly his ministry is where? Around Galilee. Not in the city. It's not that he didn't go to the city, but majority of his ministry was around Galilee. And yet, he is the deliverer for all, just like Moses was. And again, what's this pointing out is that there's all these assumptions. That's why they have to reject Jesus. Because he's speaking out against the law. He's speaking out against the temple. It's a challenge. Oh, and look, we have 23 through 29. There was a period of rejection for Moses. Remember? Picking up verse 23. It says, but when Moses was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian, which means he killed him. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. On the following day, he appeared to them as they were fighting together. He tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, men, you are brethren. Why do you injure one another? But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, who made you a ruler and judge over us? You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you? At this remark, Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. So instead of at the age of 40, really ascending to an even greater position within what he was called to do by God, what happens? Well, he has problems. So he visits, right? And what's unique is you don't find this in Exodus, but Stephen's comments are unique. It's not worded that way in that manner in Exodus, but it's inferred from understanding Joseph's position earlier in terms of his brother. Moses believed his position gave him the ability to visit, protect, and save his fellow Jews when he killed the Egyptian. That's why he did it. But we also understand, Stephen points out, then they didn't accept him. They just said, why did you, well, you killed that Egyptian. Who are you? How can you make yourself a ruler and judge over us? Because you're from there. So we read, Moses goes what? He flees to Midian. And we're told, by the way, in Exodus why, right? Because he figures out by the time these men who hadn't seen knew about Moses and that he had killed a man, he's like, well, Pharaoh's going to know as well. So he leaves. And he becomes an alien. And he became a father of two sons in an alien land. Now you see another connection here with Moses and with Jesus. So although Moses offered himself as the deliverer of his brethren, they didn't understand him. The same thing happened to Jesus, by the way. Moses' Jewish brethren, who did not recognize God had appointed him as the ruler and judge, rejected him, even though Moses sought to help them. That's the same issue that's staring the Sanhedrin in the face right now. Is that Stephen is preaching about the great deliverer, the only one who fulfills all the covenants, and this is God's promised Savior that came, that was put to death, was raised from the dead, and is the deliverer, and he's rejected by Israel as a whole. Obviously, there were Jewish people that came to faith in Jesus, but that's what the church was made up, but Israel as a nation did not accept But we're told also, capping this last section off, and this is kind of where it's like, where do you cut it off at? I don't know. Cut it off here, right? I mean, there's obviously there's more, but what I will say is we read the last verses here. What's in those last verses will then kind of tie us into the next section. And that next section is then going to be where specifically Stephen is going to talk to us, and he's going to tell us, talk to the Sanhedrin, how they don't understand what has been going on this whole time. Like, there's a point of progression for all of this, and it's connecting directly in with the charges that I'm speaking against the temple, and I'm speaking against the law. But what he's setting, he's laying down the ground, because what he's really doing, he's laying down the foundation of what God's been doing. And so let's finish off this section, and it says this. After 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to Moses in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in the flame of a burning thorn bush. When Moses saw it, he marveled at the sight. And as he approached to look more closely, there came the voice of the Lord. I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Moses shook with fear, would not venture to look. But the Lord said to him, take off the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. I have certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt and have heard their groans, and I have come down to rescue them. Come now, I will send you to Egypt. So, this is after another 40 years. Maybe Moses should be getting a knee replacement, but he's not. He's getting a call. And what's he getting a call to do? Well, he's being called to ministry. And specifically, if we're looking at this, what happens is that Moses was pastoring the flock of Jethro in Midian, and he comes to Horeb, the mountain of God, and that's when it says the angel of the Lord appeared, and of course the key is the bush he was looking at, it was like it was on fire, but it was not consumed. Which tells you the nature of those bushes. Usually, once they're on fire, they don't last long. I don't think they're quite like a tumbleweed. You want to see a tumbleweed burn? You better don't blink. But it was probably one of those deals where these bushes do not stay on fire very long because they're consumed. But it just kept being on fire. And that drew his attention. And, of course, the angel of the Lord got his attention. But it was the voice of the Lord that came out of the bush that called to Moses. Identifies himself how? He's going back to the Abrahamic covenant. How does he do that? Starts with Abraham. And then who? Isaac and Jacob. So the descendants, the firstborn. I say firstborn, now we know Jacob and Esau. We know the deal with that, right? But these are those that are in the line for the seed. So as he identifies himself, he will call him as well. But first response by Moses was the proper response, actually. Because he does what? He shakes in fear. In fact, it doesn't say it here. It does say in the text of Exodus that he tries to hide his face. There's great reverence. He is instructed to remove the sandals. God himself is calling him to this unique thing. So after identifying himself, God tells Moses he's responding to the oppression of his people in Egypt, and he's going to rescue them through sending Moses to them. And this is all in God's timing. And the interesting thing is, and we're stopping here, but you know, when we pick this up next week, and you know, we cover 35 through 53. Well, and then what happens with it, the death of Stephen. But what we're going to see is it's, even when Moses goes, it's going to be a rough go of it. There's a call, there's a definite call, there's even the conversation about the name of God. to reveal, right? It's where we get the name of, in Hebrew, we pronounce it Yahweh, right? It's not Jehovah, because there's no J's in Hebrew. There's a whole nother reason it's called Jehovah, because of its putting the vowels in the wrong place. Yahweh or Yahweh. But that's the personal name of God, which means I am. And still, that's not going to be enough, and there's going to be a lot, as we'll get into next week. But he is the one that's called. He's really been set up. First of all, people don't know about the fact that how he was saved. That's not just coincidence, right? Kind of like with Joseph, not just coincidence. Oh, wow, look at Joseph. Isn't that a wonderful tale of all these lucky things that happened to Joseph? By the way, when he was in jail, I don't think he felt lucky. But all these things happen under God's hand because God is calling out not just Joseph, but Moses. But Moses is going through a rough time. And if you think this is the worst part, no. He's been out to pasture for about 40 years, right? Then he's ready to get going. But what I look at this unusual plan by God was one of the struggles that people had with Moses, as we'll discuss next week. But what we can say in correlation to the defense here is that Jesus as the Messiah doesn't make sense to the Sanhedrin. I mean, just logically. Now, we can talk a number of reasons why. But God in the flesh makes no sense. Consider the majority are Sadducees, so they really have a struggle with supernatural. And then, by the way, they don't believe in what? Resurrection. Resurrection is foundational. What are we doing here? We celebrate what? Death or resurrection? Because if it's just death, to quote Paul, we're the most of all to be pitied if it's just about death. So it doesn't make sense. It's why they struggle with Stephen's truth about Jesus. And yet, this is how God is designed to do it. And so, but here we're given this picture of, you know, you think it's just whatever you see in the first century, it's almost like they've forgotten everything and how God called out these different individuals. We got Abraham, we got Joseph, now we have Moses. And in each case, it refers to places they were. Abraham didn't himself see the inheritance of the land, did he? And I think this is what they've done, is they've made it about location and geographical. And oh, by the way, if I think about that, there are people who think they're right with God because they go to a building that's has the word church in it, but they don't know who Jesus is. But they think if they go to a building that has the name church in it, then they're fine with God because they're doing whatever they think they need to do. And they don't understand what Jesus has done.